One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
What form is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's, yeah, they have asked for that, really.
Yeah, you can laugh. I'm the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'd say it to your face, not say it
don't
to now.
I'm down Swanfield and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawny man?
This ongoing conversation that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is having with his critics, to be honest, it's getting a little too leery for me at this point. They're like two drunks at the bar shouting the odds at each other in an increasingly agitated manner. They're just starting to wreck the buzz of everyone else in the place. You see Ole there on one stool.
Oh, what do you think of that performance against Leipzig, you prick? 4-0, 5-0, whatever. You were fucking class, did you see it?
And then the critics are all one person for this analogy.
Yeah, well, you're bleeding shite yesterday, fucking standing there saying nothing on the sideline. Well, Arteta gave actual instructions to his team, you big dope, Ole. And so on for the rest of the season as Manchester United threatened to become.
What? No, please. Oh, no, just get to the end. Yeah, okay. No,
so this is kind of a Juno and the Peacock style.
Yeah, it is.
jocks are.
Yeah.
I'm only after beating Leipzig 5-0 and all and anyways.
I should have said and all and anyways. That was teed up for it.
Oh, right, God. Yeah. Horrendous.
Ah, there was a bit more that intro, but who cares? That's it. Welcome to the Second Captain's Football Podcast. Hi there, Murph. Hi, Ken.
Owen, how are you? Good to hear from you and all the voices in your head.
there are a few. Those were just two of those voices that you heard just there. Murph, I hope you're well. Hope you've had a nice week off, Ken. Refreshed, ready to talk about. There was some gloating from the Solskjaer backers, which you weren't around to hear. You know, kind of what does Ken think of the Solskjaer conversation now, huh? But unfortunately, you weren't here last week and now you are here. And the tone has changed once again after yesterday. So we will get into all that in a couple of minutes' time. But I've got some big news for you straight off the bat. Guess who's back? And you thought lockdown number two was going to be Grimsville. Not anymore. Our hero. The hero we all need in this crazy world. Lord Doddlesworth is isolating once again. This time it is Babe 2, Doddles in the City, according to the man himself. This is also perfect timing for all you UK-based listeners who are going back into lockdown. And look, depending what happens in the US elections, the entire world might be in need of a bit of their spirits being lifted once again in the next few days. Murph, this is incredible news. The national mood, the international mood has shifted. I can feel it.
I know. I mean, November 2020 had all the... It had all the potential to be a real pain in the ass, but Doddles has stepped forth, and we thank him for it. I mean, it's an extraordinarily selfless thing that he's doing on our behalf. So we appreciate you. We thank you, David. And here's to some jigsaw chat. I mean, just the word jigsaw. I haven't said it now, and it seems like
Thursday.
Years.
It's a bit cold for tops off November, but I mean, I can only
I think
imagine.
He's already on the record as saying that nothing will change. If it's
don't
Thursday,
take
your freaking top off.
Take your top off. All right. Same story as last time. Monday and Thursday episodes free to everyone. But why deny yourself the full isolating experience? Daily episodes available to members from Monday to Friday. You can sign up now for £5 a month plus VAT. Just go to secondcaptains.com/join. And you can now pay in euro or sterling if you're signing up. Before now, Patreon had only been dealing in dollars. But there's a euro option now if you're living, well, if you're living in Euroland, and a sterling option if you're in the UK. That also goes for current members, by the way, if you legends want to change your currency, you can log into Patreon, click on your profile, just go into manage memberships and you can edit your currency from there. Just make sure you type in €5 to the little box if you're changing as a current member. Episode 1 is out today, so let's all get isolating. And that's not to mention all the live sport going on at the moment. There's obviously the Six Nations, which we're going to talk about tomorrow. GAA Hurling and Football Championships are going on. We'll deal with that, I would say, on Wednesday. Atalanta-Liverpool is among the big games in Champions League this week. So there'll be tons to talk about on the regular midweek shows. And next week on the World Service, we're going to be doing a special Q&A podcast all about Where is George Gibney? So if you've been loving the series, as I have, and if you have any questions that you want me to put to Mark Horgan, email them in to editor@secondcaptains.com and just use the subject title, Where is George Gibney? So send it into the usual editor address, editor@secondcaptains.com, if you wouldn't mind including the subject title, Where is George Gibney? So we can keep a special eye on those ones. That'll be next week. Right now, it's time to report on sport, Ken.
Well, I suppose we should start with the gutless cowards at Old Trafford last night. After the cowardly performance of the cowards against Chelsea, you might have thought that that they might produce a bit more against Arsenal, but no. Again, no men, no leaders, no passion. Did you see? I mean, I've been talking here about Roy Keane and well, particularly Roy Keane, but like Tim Cahill as well. Cahill was like, oh, there's no leaders, there's no passion. But like Keane just screaming about how you've just got to go and smash somebody. Like, did you see this?
Ken, I'm going to be honest with you. I was working on the Spurs game in Premier Sports last night. I got home and I heard a bit about what Keane said. And I thought, will I watch this? I've been either watching football or working on football all weekend. And I thought, life is too short to hear Roy Keane giving me his definition of manhood once again.
What you've just said there, Ken, is the sum total of everything that I've heard, like a 3-second clip on Twitter of Roy Keane saying that. And honestly, I'm in exactly the same boat as all. I spent all bloody weekend watching sport, be it rugby, GA or football. And the idea that I would go back and actively seek out what Roy Keane has to say about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's Manchester United, oh, not in a million years, Ken. Not in a million years.
Well, that was pretty much the way, you know, they have lost because they are not men. But I was just thinking, like, Roy Keane is actually sitting there at Old Trafford, right? At Old Trafford, the stadium where Manchester United, of course, have not managed to win a game this season, and they've lost 3 out of 4 matches, and it's all pretty bad, and it's been empty for all those games. And it was empty apart from, you know, Roy Keane, Jamie Redknapp, Tim Cahill, a few of the Sky technicians, and the teams, and all those everyone they need to keep an empty stadium open. So Keane knew exactly what kind of atmosphere this game was being played in, and yet he's still going on about how the crucial missing thing here is somebody smashing somebody, getting in somebody's face. And I'm thinking, this is so insane. Run it through in your head. What do you think actually happens if you do that in this situation? I mean,
get a red card.
Well, you're definitely going to get a red card. Because what happens in a normal circumstance, when Roy Keane was smashing people, getting in someone's face, he actually said at one point, and he kind of trailed off, but he said, smash someone's face, get in someone's face, stand over them. And I thought he trailed off. And I thought, are you talking about what I think you're... Is this an actual... Because that wasn't a good moment. Even in a full Old Trafford, you got sent off for that. But look, the point of doing this is to get the crowd going, right? It's to get the atmosphere going. You know, you hit an opponent with like a borderline tackle. There's a big roar. There's a pulse of energy around the stadium. The plates of the game are maybe shifting a little bit beneath the feet of the players. Like, that's what you're trying to do. That is the whole point of being aggressive in that way. If there's no crowd, then All it is the scream of your stricken opponent rending night air, and then the official going over to the monitor to confirm that yes, you were about to be sent off. Like, it was just ridiculous. Like, think about what's going on. Solskjaer at least has grasped this. Like, there was a quote from Solskjaer last week, which honestly is the most sense I've ever heard him make, where he was talking about this whole thing. He said, it's actually the most that I've seen any manager, as far as I can see, talk about how different this is from sort of normal football. It's a completely different game without the fans. I can't remember anyone else sort of openly admitting this in the way that Solskjaer does here. Playing in empty stadiums takes all the passion and excitement out of the game. I mean, it's a fairly definitive statement, but it's one which I think is basically correct. He says, and when players are no longer feeding off the buzz of the crowd and doing what their instinct tells them in the heat of the moment, tactics come more into it because you can see how each side is being set up. In normal circumstances, players react to the crowd, whatever their manager tells them to do. At the moment, that's not happening as much. I think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is completely correct about this. I think it's something which obviously, okay, Manchester United won games at home in the empty stadium over the summer, that's true. But for a game like this Arsenal game, I think they missed their crowd. I mean, I was watching the fact that I was on holidays in my house didn't mean that I didn't pay any attention whatsoever to the football that was going on. I did watch some of the Champions League, the sad and grim Champions League.
You found it sad and grim?
Well, did you see, for instance, the Man City Marseille, or Marseille Man City? Like, I mean, this is just like that. If you think about it, I was looking at it thinking, wow, the last time that I was at that stadium, that was the day of the Russia England in Euro 2016.
Oh, wow, yeah, well, that was eventful.
It was eventful. I mean, there was some atmosphere, you could say. maybe a little too much atmosphere. But, like, the whole thing of the, you know, I remember it as such an enjoyable day. I mean, okay, there was a lot of terror in the town and all that sort of stuff. You know, there was a frisson of real terror, sure. And, you know, maybe that was unnecessary. But, like, just in terms of the big match atmosphere.
Great clarification there, Ken, by the way. Sure, a lot of people were terrified. In fact, the majority of people were terrified. But what a great day all the same.
There were some serious injuries. There was that sort of sense of skin in the game. You know what I mean? Skin in the game. I'm walking to the stadium and I feel like I've got skin in the game, skin in the bacon slicer. Now, I'm not saying you necessarily need that, but a great football city like Marseille, jewel of the Mediterranean, well, one of the jewels, that great temple of football, the Stade Velodrome, and usually going to be full of Marseille fans who are absolutely going crazy about, you know, and this city, this awful manifestation of Petro dominance, which they're battling against in Ligue 1, and now here they are fighting it again in the Champions League, and it has all the ingredients of, like, this can be a spectacular game, even though it's only a Champions League group game and no one really cares that much. They're always a bit boring, you know what I mean? But this could be a good one, and instead it's just like it was the game with the biggest gap between what it should be and the, like, sad reality of.
So you think that gap is even more pronounced in the Champions League than in the Premier League?
Yes, because, and as well because of the, like, the incessant, like, the incessant sort of it's always on. Like, why is this thing always on? Like, just think about what a grind it is for the players, is what I'm thinking. Like, Klopp was saying the other day, look, October is like a normal December for the players. Like, you know, in terms of the number of games that they have to play, because there's three international games in there as well, with the club games. November is like a normal December. Then there's December, which is like a normal December. So, you know, it's like, what do you expect us to do? He was complaining about the five subs thing, which I think we can get back to, because everyone was complaining about it. I didn't think it was a coincidence that all the managers who were involved in the grim, drab, depressing Champions League were the ones who were kicking off about the five subs. Like, you know, having to fly to Marseille to play in an empty stadium, having to go through the empty airports to go to the empty stadium to play this boring game. You know, it's just like, this isn't what it's meant to be like. Do you remember we did that, or a couple of years ago, we were talking about that study that the Irish researcher had done at Everton, Tom Riley, this Mayo sports scientist who had done
this is back in the day. It was an old sir thing.
Yeah,
is
it? Early, it was early 70s at Everton, and he basically did the first kind of high quality study of like how a football team works, you know, like with looking at all of their sort of physiological data and trying to integrate, you know, all of recording all the training they did and sort of the personalities of the players and the sort of fluctuations in the mood of the players and trying to like put together like a picture of what was actually going on in this team. You know, this, he was sort of the first person to do this. And one of the things that he mentions in that report was that his conclusion about the profession, about professional football, was that the players, the profession that it most resembled was acting. The players were like actors. Like they were essentially, they spent most of their day lying on their back, thinking about their next performance. Like long periods of total inactivity punctuated by extreme bursts of frenetic performance, mm-hmm. which were very highly stressed, but also this was the energy that they live for, also contributing to a sort of what he, you know, he said like a very bitchy, insecure, jealous work environment where people really are living from performance to performance. And you know, he said, look, it's people think that being a footballer is like any of the other working class jobs, you know, being a bricklayer. It's not like that. It's totally different. Like, you know, it is a performance occupation. And it's like these are showmen who are now performing to nobody. You know what I mean? It's like, it's a weird... Because, there's all kinds of actors. Like, I mean, obviously, if you're a film actor... Then
I was just going to bring that up. Yeah, exactly. Hmm. There are different types of disciplines in acting. And I guess you, now by default... those different types of disciplines are now required in football. And that is to say that sometimes you have to perform with just a director and a few other people watching you.
Yeah. So we're about to see the sort of the understated film actors coming out. But at the moment, the game is dominated by like bellowing theater actors, stage actors who are used to raising their voice and acting that stilted theatrical way, you know, getting into people's faces, smashing people and all that kind of stuff. Whereas maybe the future is, if this goes on much longer, it's going to belong to these real, you know, people who act with just the imperceptible lift of an eyebrow, you know, the whatever the equivalent of that is in football terms. Most of them, though, are used to having fans there screaming in response to everything they do. I mean, okay, everyone starts out playing without crowds. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like most kids' games. You know, actually, even kids' games do tend to have some crowds. There are parents at the games. So, you know what I mean? It's a really weird situation. For them to be in. And I think, honestly, that it does have something to do with the inconsistency of not just Man United, but of every team. Like, I mean, why you've seen so many stupid things happening. This incessant sort of grind of game after game after game. It's just difficult to be consistent. It's like, how can you keep doing this? Like, it's just... I think not many players actually are capable of doing it. Some of them
surely
are.
Is that all of a way of saying that you are giving Solskjaer a bit of a free pass on Manchester United's performance yesterday? Then,
no, I mean not completely, because like I think there's still problems with Solskjaer. Like, you know, for instance, like did you see Harry Maguire's interview after the game?
Again, life too short.
Okay, right. Well, so actually, Solskjaer after the game seemed a bit puzzled as to what. He was like, I can't put my finger on it. I think Maguire used the same phrase, I can't put my finger on it. We weren't at the races, Solskjaer saying. But then someone mentioned Leipzig, and he said, you know, basically, how can you beat Leipzig 5-0 and then lose in this way so badly? Like, you know, how can you be so good 3 days ago? And he said, well, maybe that is the reason. You know, which is what I thought, actually, okay, I think he's probably right there. You know, in the sense, and Maguire after the game was like, oh, maybe everyone was patting us on the back too much. You know, you have to remain level-headed. And I sort of thought, well, yeah, Harry, that should be part of your job because you are the captain of the team. You know what I mean? If you think that people are getting carried away or with the praise of their great performance against Leipzig, then it actually is part of your responsibility to try and ensure that like they're not getting carried away by that. But I do feel as though It is difficult to just string together these performances again and again. United had to play Leipzig during the week, and Arsenal only had to play Dundalk. Now, I say only had to play Dundalk. I don't mean to be patronising to Dundalk. I don't mean to suggest it was a walk in the park for Arsenal. But if you went for a walk in the park, you wouldn't expect anyone to kick you, right? And Dundalk did not kick Arsenal. Like, literally, they did not commit a foul against Arsenal. I think I read that it was a first in the Europa League.
They didn't commit a foul in the game.
No, they didn't commit a foul. That's how. So, you know, I don't think it was Arsenal's hardest game of the season. Did someone tell me that the foul, I haven't independently confirmed, but it was something like 20-0. It sounds like it must be exaggerated, the foul count. Sure, how could Arsenal have committed 20 fouls? I could look that up. But the point is, Dundalk apparently did not commit a foul. I think it was an easier week to prepare for this game, so that Mikel Arteta was basically working with his first team. The team that played Dundalk was quite different. Whereas obviously when United were playing Leipzig, okay, they made a couple of changes, but it was like Leipzig is a big game as well, and winning that game is important. Whereas with Dundalk, Arsenal were pretty sure they could win that and could totally prioritise the United game. Solskjaer did actually say after the game, which I was surprised he said, because it made things worse for him, I thought. But he's saying, we knew all week that this was the big game. Leipzig would look after itself. Did you see him saying that? We knew this was the big one. And Leipzig would look after itself. And, you know, we still couldn't do it. And I thought, oh, you're like butting it, mate. Like, there's no need for you to talk yourself even further down. Like, let other people do that for you. Like, but I kind of
admired the honesty of that one, I have to say.
I thought it was, I don't know if it was admiring the, it was kind of like, oh no, there goes Solskjaer. His mouth works slightly faster than his brain. Like, maybe he realizes after it's come out, he's like, oh, I shouldn't have said that. But like, it was true. You know, I'm not saying the mouth is always wrong. Just maybe that it was injudicious of him to actually say. But yeah, I mean, so I think that Arsenal played like a team who'd been working on a game plan all week and knew what they were going to do from the first minute. And I think it's
longer than a week, though. Do you know what I mean? Like Arteta has a style of play that he didn't come up with at the start of this week, that he was allowed, you know, 3 or 4 days more preparation time because he was playing Dundalk instead of RB Leipzig. You know, like the reality is that, like, this is the same Solskjaer that's always been there. You know that, like, there will be a couple of big wins and then there will be just, you know, devastatingly poor performances. There will be another big win coming down the tracks, like in a couple of weeks. I don't know in what game that would be, PSG at home maybe, or Leipzig away or whatever. But like, this is it. Like, you know, he's got 100 games. We still don't have a clue. He doesn't have a clue what he's what his best team is. He has a ton of really good players that will on occasion win him big games, but like, that's just the reality of it. Like, you could talk about, like, it's very hard for him to go 3 or 4 days keep winning games, but like, that's the job. That's literally the job of Manchester United manager, is to not, you know, like, it's okay for Brendan Rodgers to go on a streak of 8 or 10 wins and then just quietly lose a ton of games for Leicester. You know, no one's really going to call him on it. Like, it's, you know, that's the job. You have to do it, like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there are things like, say, for instance, again in Harry Maguire's interview, he was saying, you know, well, we went with it because the diamond, that is the you know, Manchester United's diamond. You know, things move so fast now. They bring the diamond out against Leipzig and shred Leipzig, and you know, then it's like, oh, the diamond is the, you know, we've hit the mother load. Like, this is it. You know, we finally unearthed the secret that's going to unleash our power. And they play the diamond against Arsenal and they just get absolutely wiped. You know, like, they had to change it at halftime because they barely got a touch of the ball. I think the statistic was 3 touches in Arsenal's box, which was their lowest, the lowest number of touches in the opposition box United have had for like 3 years. So that would have been the lowest, certainly since Solskjaer was at the club. You know, like a total failure to really get in the game. Arsenal are just cutting out all the passes to Greenwood and Martial, or not Martial, Rashford. Rashford only got in space one time in the whole half, and he managed to play Greenwood in for what was the closest thing to a chance that they had. But generally speaking, he just couldn't get the ball. You know, it was like and Arsenal were playing a fairly familiar formation, which notably is different from what Leipzig do. This is the sort of confused aspect of what Solskjaer is doing. I think it's like, wow, that works so well, let's do it again. But this game is totally different against the team that sets up very differently from Leipzig. Are we sure that the same plan will work? You know, come on, let's, you know, once you've, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. That seems to be the kind of the logic underpinning it. And it's like, oh no, this doesn't work. Actually, this has completely failed. Like, you know, Arsenal did, they play a similar type of system to the one they use in sort of their big games, but like it was a very different expression of it. Say, for instance, if you think back to their game at Anfield earlier this season, they lost 3-1 to Liverpool. Now, the thing that sticks in my memory about that game is the extraordinary situations that developed where Arsenal were trying to play the ball out from the back by moving the ball out to the corner flags. Do you remember these?
It's like an extreme version of Pep ball, essentially.
It really was, but it was like, okay, we're playing against a team that's going to come chasing us in our own third, and if we want to counteract that and make the pitch big, we're actually going to have to use like all of the space, including out to our corner flags. Now, you know, ultimately, did it work? Not really. I mean, they lost 3-1. They didn't really have too many chances. Maybe if they'd got lucky, it could have gone a bit differently. But this game, okay, they're playing this, you know, the team looks the same on paper, but this time they're playing completely in Manchester United's half. Now, is this because they're not worried about what Manchester United can do with them in the counter-attack? They're confident that they can deal with those. They can cut Greenwood and Rashford out of the game, that United aren't going to be able to get the ball forward. One way or the other, Arsenal used the same system, but they played in Manchester United's half. You know, if you look actually at the sort of pressing stats of the season so far, obviously we're early in the season, but which team do you think has the lowest number of pressures of the opposing team?
Probably have to say Manchester United, considering you've teed it up that way.
The context would suggest Manchester United. Now, it is true that Manchester United have played 6 games and other teams have played 7 games. So you do have to factor that in. But their number is actually so low that even if they were to play another game at the same rate, they would still be bottom of this table. They would still be bottom of the table. And it's also the sort of the shape of the pressing, which is a bit worrying. Like in the sense of you can analyze it by defensive third, middle third, attacking third. You know what I mean? For instance, which team has by far the most number of pressures in the attacking third of the pitch?
Liverpool.
Yes. Okay. So by far, 282 and the next, or rather 382 of these instances in their 7 matches so far. And the next highest is 282, which is Sheffield United, which probably you wouldn't have guessed. That's David McGoldrick, the man.
He was responsible for 268 of those.
The man does a lot of work. They also have, I think they've got the second lowest success rate in terms of their pressures, but that doesn't mean they don't keep doing it. Sheffield United are going to chase you. So Liverpool, you were able to guess that Liverpool are top because they've got such a clear style. Like everybody knows that's what they do. Manchester United are fifth bottom in this. Wolves are bottom because everybody knows Wolves don't press. Wolves completely just defend in their own third. That's sort of their style. In midfield, Manchester United are bottom. In the defensive third, Manchester United are second bottom. It's sort of like where do they try to focus their efforts?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's a bit worrying. Like Everton, for instance, are very high up in midfield pressing. They're the top midfield pressing team in the league this season. It has to do with the fact that they've brought in like Alan and Doucouré, both of whom are really individually high in this. You know what I mean? They're players who you can see there's a focus, there's a structure to what Everton are trying to do here. With Manchester United, you're just kind of like, where are they even trying to win the game? You know what I mean? It's about sort of ultimately relying on Marcus Rashford to win the game for you. And unfortunately, that's not going to be enough in every game. Especially, you know, as you can't expect Rashford to score a hat-trick every time. There's also one other thing that I should mention, which is you do wonder how things might have turned out if Gabriel had been sent off for Arsenal, as he clearly should have been, for a second yellow card foul on Mason Greenwood. And I'm kind of looking at that, how is that not a red card? I mean, it wasn't a red card, but it was definitely a yellow card, and he'd already been booked, so he should be off. And he was an absolute giant in the closing stages of the game for Arsenal, and just repelling everything at the back. He shouldn't have been on the pitch. So we can say all this, you know, about Solskjaer, and Arteta will be the one who gets the credit for like the big brain and the plan. And in fairness, okay, there is a lot of that going on. But like, there's still these random elements, and the Gabriel thing just strikes me as, it was a week when I thought there was a lot of like just wrong VAR decisions.
Are you talking about the Spurs game as well? Because as I said, I was paying more attention to that one last night.
Well, I was watching you.
There were a couple of dodgy ones there. Oh yeah, very very nice. Yeah.
I was a bit puzzled though as to why Kenny Cunningham was so skeptical about Tottenham's ability to win the league. I'm kind of like, who else does he think is going to win it? You know, if you just look around, if you assume that there's like more than one contender team, then Tottenham have to be one of the contenders.
Well, he said, if you're talking about somebody that's not Liverpool, he said Chelsea was a lot more likely than Spurs. But yeah, that was even after the game. So it was after Spurs had dug out the win and all the rest of it. He wasn't giving them a sniff of the championship, of the league.
The Kane penalty in that game was ridiculous. This, how can that be given as and it's not a foul against Kane? The Brighton goal, how is that not disallowed? When you look at it, I saw there was an explanation from Mark Clattenburg, who was saying both teams should be aggrieved. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. This is a Brighton goal by Lamptey, where there was a foul by Sully March on Højbjerg, yeah, as he was trying to take the ball out of defence. And it was really obvious, like he chopped them down, you know. Yeah. And there was a tiny touch of like his boot on the ball, but it was Højbjerg's touch that had moved the ball away. You know, Højbjerg had sort of towed the ball away from the situation, and he's now going to ride the tackle, he hopes, and get back. But March just absolutely takes him out, and it's a clear foul. Clattenburg says, no, the goal should stand because...
Graham Scott was a ref.
Graham Scott. Clattenburg says the goal should... This is Clattenburg in the Daily Mail, where I think he's got some kind of a column. The goal should stand because it happened... The foul happened so far back in the move that VAR shouldn't even be looking at it. So basically, his case was that this shouldn't even... Brighton should be aggrieved that this even was looked at by VAR because it's so far back in the move, it shouldn't be looked at. There's actually four passes, as he mentions in his own... And I'm kind of like, that's not a lot. Like, I mean, it's the same. It's the same phase. The foul starts off the phase of play.
Brighton dispossessed Spurs and then go and score a goal straight away. I don't really see how much more direct it can be.
To me, that's like, it's one phase of play. Now, I mean, you can get this like a phase of play, which is like, oh, 30 passes from one end of the field to the other. And you're kind of like, well, should that count as one phase? But like this, you know, they win the ball and then immediately play it back into the Spurs box and it's a goal.
On the edge of the box, like, you know, it was right there.
I thought that was a terrible decision. And once you're looking at it, the point is, once you're looking at it, you surely have to see it's a foul. But as you can see, the referee then says to, like, Harry Kane as he walks back on, he got the ball.
He got a little bit. You could see him doing the universal gesture for a little. You know, he got a little touch, but which isn't the point. You know, you can get a little touch and still wipe out the man and it's still a free kick. But what was interesting was... I think you said it there, that he went over to so this is the first time all season a referee has been told by the VAR to go over and have a look himself. In other words, you've got it wrong, mate, so change your decision. But the referee it's the first time that has happened and the ref has decided, no, I'm sticking by my completely incorrect decision. F off, Harry Kane. I'm getting this one wrong and I'm sticking with it.
I'm sticking with it. So that was that. I mean, a wrong decision. There was a wrong decision, I thought, to disallow the Diogo Jota goal. I mean, he obviously went and scored another one, which wasn't disallowed. But I thought he scored a goal, which I thought was a good goal.
Wasn't sure about that. This is when Mane slid into the keeper.
Yeah, but Mane didn't slide into the keeper.
Passed the ball and made kind of rammed into the keeper who was coming out to try to get it.
I didn't think it was a foul. Like, does he touch the goalkeeper? I mean, it looked to me as though the main danger there was Mane getting Pickforded.
He was he was a little out of control.
I mean, I thought if that's the foul, the game's gone.
His speed off the mark to even get there, by the way, is a joke. Like, he was by no means favored. He didn't quite get there, I suppose, but he was a good bit behind the defender, and the keeper had a decent chance to come out and clear it. And suddenly, Mane, how did Mane slide in there so fast?
He's got that ability to really just get just project himself let's say. But I thought he projected himself very safely with his foot right down low. It actually went underneath, or the goalkeeper sort of landed on him. But apparently that's a foul now. We're calling it a foul these days. And what was the other one? And then there was this. I see Tony Coscarino was getting a few pelters online for suggesting that Mo Salah's disgusting dive for the penalty he was given shames or insults the memory of Nobby Styles. Nobby Styles, as you know, sadly passed away in the last couple of days. And Coscarino, the headline on Coscarino's piece suggests that this is an insult to his, you know, it's a shame that Mo Salah sullies this proud tradition that's been handed down to us by the likes of Nobby Styles by diving in such a disgraceful way. It's not a dive. You know, I get the feeling maybe Coscarino saw this once and then he's just, I'm afraid the headline writer has made more of it than perhaps on reflection he would have made, because it's absolutely a ridiculous point. But I suppose it shows how people can get things wrong even when they see the footage.
So bad week for VAR. What else was going on?
Yeah, the other thing was, are Chelsea beginning to roll now a little bit? You said Kenny Cunningham was impressed. It's reassuring for them, I suppose, that they've got that Werner's scoring now. Although he wasn't supposed to play, I don't think.
No, he came in late because Pulisic was injured in the warm-up, I think. But there, when you look at the players Chelsea have, I mean, if Lampard turns out, and I know the jury's out, but if he turns out to be even a competent manager, he should have a good crack with that team. Their midfield, they can basically choose between Kante and Jorginho or play both of them. Their attackers are obviously ridiculous, and all managers would like to have this so-called problem of how do you fit them all into the one team. Mm-hmm. Full-backs are good, and defensively they're decent enough. We'll see how Thiago Silva sort of settles in over the next while. So really, if the goalkeeper situation is sorted, which it seems to be, they're. I'm saying it's Lampard's league to lose, Ken.
Well, the thing, the encouraging thing, I suppose, for Lampard at the moment is the 5 clean sheets in the last 6 matches. You know, and they're scoring quite. I mean, the results are kind of weird. 4-0 against Palace, 3-3 against Southampton, which obviously wasn't good. That's not good. And then, so I think the 3-3, you know, Frank Lampard decided, okay, we really need to tighten things up now. And he tightened things, really, really tightened things up. So it was 0-0 then against Sevilla, and then 0-0 against Man United. And that was a real, real tight game. Tightened defence. But he's managed to loosen up the attack against Krasnodar and Burnley. 4-0 against Burnley, and 3-0 against Burnley. Krasnodar, there were fans at that game, I should mention. That was in Russia and they were letting fans in. But, you know, there was something about the sight of fans at that game that wasn't reassuring either. I'm not sure about this. But look,
all just like spread out just a little bit? I mean, I know it's Krasnodar. I don't think it's a major concern for me here in Inchicore. But all the same, if you could all just spread out just a tiny bit.
Just looking at that stand. But yeah, but the point is scoring goals and not conceding. So that's the ideal situation. And I see that young Mason Mount is
you're really explaining this wonderfully, Ken, by the way. So tight in some places, loose further in others. Up the field. Really good. Yeah, really good.
It's a question of twiddling certain knobs, loosening others. And it looks like Frank's got the balance right. Who knows how much longer it can stay that way. But I do have to say Mason Mount is exceeding my expectations in terms of how he's staying in the team, and if you look at it at how he's doing it, he's just working his ass off basically. You can say that Mason Mount is not as talented as Kai Havertz, sure, you could say that, but you also have to say that Mason Mount presses twice as much as Kai Havertz everywhere, all over the pitch, twice as much. Twice
is that
as
an
much.
Actual stat, or is that just feeding it?
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, I mean, it's an actual approximate stat. Maybe it's, you know, it's an act. Maybe it's like 2 to 1.1 as opposed to 2 to 1. But Mount has basically decided, I'm just going to outwork everybody. He's the top presser in the team. Remember, the team includes players like N'Golo Kante. Mount is working harder than anybody, shooting plenty as always. Ultimately, there's two things that managers these days, the modern manager, remembers. One of them is pressing stats, and you know, this is covered in all the stuff that your little vest is going to transmit to his laptop, and the other is goals. And if you can stand out in both of those areas, I mean, he's only got one goal maybe this season, is that correct? One in the league. But the point is he shoots a lot. And if you shoot a lot, you will eventually start scoring. And I think that Mason Mount is going about the business of retaining his place in the team against some pretty tough competition with an admirable focus and intelligence.
So, for you to ask that question, pretty strange. Yeah, very disappointed, yeah, but there you go.
What have I become? My sweetest friend.
I mean, at the time I thought that you were completely in the right.
Everyone I know.
But now I think goes away. Should have just played in, just played in.
I'm surprised you're really asking that question.
And you could have it all.
No, well, it doesn't matter really what you think.
My empire of dirt.
Yeah, you weren't there at the time.
I will let you down.
You weren't an international player.
I will make you hurt.
And you hadn't had the frustrations I had.
If I could start again.
You've not played at the international level.
A million miles away.
And you hadn't been accused of taking an injury, so.
I will keep myself.
What you think doesn't really matter.
I would find a way.
Dion and Miguel are ready to chat about the, well, I suppose the big game of the weekend undoubtedly was going to be Arsenal, especially now that they won at Manchester United. I mean, some people have called Arteta's Arsenal boring, Dion. There's nothing boring about winning away at a top six club for the first time in more than 5 years, is there?
No, I don't think so. I think it's, if you're asking a manager to be kind of progressing and evolving the side, Arteta is doing a lot of the things in general that you would want him to do. And I think there was a performance that also just put into, you know, it was just so easy to contrast with what Manchester United were doing or not doing, that I think Arsenal come out of the game looking very good. And I thought the first half Arsenal were really good, and I quite enjoyed the game in the first half. But I suppose there is also that sense now of the sort of psychodrama with Manchester United, and as they struggle to kind of impose any sort of authority on the game, that becomes compelling in itself as well.
Yeah, it's almost impossible not to get dragged straight into that, Miguel. But I do want to give Arsenal just a little bit of their own airtime first. Is this maybe the most obvious sign yet that Arteta is going somewhere with this team?
Yeah, and I think it was a landmark for Arsenal in that regard, that Arteta did feel it was important. I had to do a piece in this in the build-up to the game, which is basically on where Arsenal are. And probably because in the last few games, they felt maybe a little bit stale or flat. I hadn't quite kicked on in the way you'd expect from some of the flashes of last season. Like, say, even the goals in the semi-final against Manchester City, the fact they won the FA Cup, and even the way they started this season against Fulham. Like, I had a look at their stats and all the underlying figures that they say these days, and they were something like 17th in the league for pressing stats, or as they call it in Opta, defensive actions, or sorry, passes per defensive actions. And also they'd only had more shots than Newcastle, West Brom and Crystal Palace.
Well, might that though have also been sort of distorted by, I mean, they were away to Man City, weren't they? They were away to Liverpool. I mean, they barely touched the ball, I remember, in the Liverpool game. So there was, you know, at this point in the season, that could have a huge effect on what your stats look like.
Well, completely, yeah. I think that's really what the underlying issue is. And also, I suppose, I mean, you wouldn't expect those sort of figures from a manager, say, that's supposed to be of the same school as Bielsa, Guardiola, all the rest of it. But I think maybe there is a little bit more pragmatism about him. And also because, I mean, it's difficult not to return to the personnel in that Arsenal squad. And the fact he doesn't really have all the attackers he wants. And the solution so far has been to try and ensure solidity, especially in those games. And I think we saw the fruits of that this Sunday. And they do look that much more secure. I mean, they have the best defensive record in the division now. And I mean, it's difficult not to keep returning to Manchester United in this, as you said. Mm. But it was. I mean, one thing I kept thinking watching this game was, imagine Arsenal with United's firepower. I mean, there is a significant difference in the players they have available in attack.
Yeah. Well, I mean, imagine United with Arsenal's manager. I mean, with that...
That's what I mean, yeah. I think... I mean, someone said to me mid-game yesterday, this is basically a game between a team with a manager who can coach in a few different ways and one who can't.
Yeah. Dion, the... Okay, let's talk about Man United.
We've got Arsenal out of the way now.
That's them done.
What more can we say? It was great stuff from Arsenal. Everybody agrees. But, you know, they're not the first team to beat Manchester United at home this season. They're the third team to beat them at home in four matches. I think Duncan Alexander had a couple of tweets about this. Only in two Premier League seasons have Man United lost more home games than this. So 0-1, 0-2, and 13-14. But we have only played four games of this season. Also that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has lost as many home Premier League games as Steve Bruce at Newcastle. Now, what do you think is going on there? Is it a question, as Tim Cahill and Roy Keane suggest afterwards, that there's a lack of men, a lack of leaders?
No, I don't think so. Well, I think there is. There is a lack of leaders, and the lack of leader is in the management. Like, that's the clear thing. It was an extraordinary... analysis from Keane, in the sense that, like, listening to his analysis, you would think, well, what's the point in having a manager at all? Like, there is no, if you frame things the way Roy Keane frames things, it's like there is no point in having a manager. Everybody should be driven by some internal drive that they had since they were 8 years old, and that should sustain them. And the manager is probably there just to kind of point out their failings once in a while, and what they're doing wrong. And apart from that, everything else should come from within. And it's, Manchester United are clearly an example. And, you know, you can go back and forth between United and Arsenal on this in this context too, because, United are a team that look like they have a manager who hasn't got any clear idea of what he wants them to do. It jumps around, like, and I think in some ways Solskjaer is actually the perfect manager for the current Manchester United, the institution, because they're flailing all over the place. They don't know really what they want to do. Ed Woodward doesn't know what he wants to do, and they have a manager who personifies that. And all they have is hope. Like, you know, they get when United do get a good result in the Champions League or. A couple of good results, there is this sense of, oh, maybe Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is going to do it. Maybe this is it. Maybe he's turned the corner. And yet everybody knows deep down that there isn't evidence of a manager who is evolving the side, who knows what he wants to do. Like Gary Neville said last night after the game, that it's time for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer to start making some tough decisions. He's been there for 100 matches. Like, you know, and again, if you want to compare him to Arteta, like, Arteta made a tough decision with Ozil, which wasn't really a tough decision at all, but he made it, and he made it very quickly. But it's not time. Like, it's time, if it's only time now for Solskjaer to be making the tough decisions, it actually proves that he's not the manager who can make tough decisions.
What do you reckon, Miguel?
Yeah, I'd agree with all of that, to be honest. Making some for some dull potting. But I think more broadly, I mean, obviously I've been listening over the past few weeks and the back and forth about Solskjaer and his critics, the conversation he has with his critics in that regard. But, I mean, as Dion kind of points to there, it's hard to escape this general truth. I mean, A, we all fundamentally know he's probably not up to it, or certainly not the top manager that a club like Manchester United have. And for all the talk about, you know, whether he's developing on the job and all this, United shouldn't be a finishing school for anyone. I mean, they're a super club. They're in a position where it's got to be someone close to the cutting edge of the game. But more broad, I think you probably do have to give Solskjaer some credit for some of the performance, say, in the Champions League, when, especially this month, when it did look like the whole thing was spiralling out of control after the 6-1. And that points to the fact the players are playing for him and do like him. And I, as someone kind of close to the club put to me, though, they like him, but do they fully respect him? Which is the wider issue. And I think the kind of cycle United are in now, it feels, with Solskjaer, is that it'll be good and there'll be some good wins and moments to point to, but never good enough for there to be real progress. But at the same time, because of some of those wins, like against PSG, like against Leipzig, it'll never be bad enough to sack him unless someone takes a strong football decision. And that means more likely, I mean, and this could be the kind of logical or natural consequence of what the Glazers are all about. This kind of, and previously Arsenal, a perpetual top four, where it's this kind of strange purgatory. Although looking at the table today, you'd start to doubt whether top four is possible. That's what it's going to come down to with this United regime. They wouldn't sack Solskjaer, basically, unless getting back into the Champions League is impossible. But while there's still the possibility of qualifying for it, he'll stay in the job, and United will kind of be in this status with a manager who they all like, but really, he's not going to get them back to where they need to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's never going to be a football decision, you know, from Glazers, but it will be like a league position decision. You know, that's how they decide to move on a manager. And at the moment, okay, they've had this terrible start, terrible home start, but they still have a chance. You know, they can still get to the top four. So they're not going to do anything for now. So Solskjaer then has to make these big decisions that Gary Neville was talking about. What do you think he actually should do? Because he does at this point have quite a few options. I mean, he was talking about this last week. You know, we're looking a bit like a Man United squad, he said. We've got, you know, a lot of players, which I suppose creates the quandary for him of which players to use. And I'm a bit puzzled as to what he's doing, because he did take what seemed to be a big decision in recent weeks by leaving Paul Pogba out of the games after the 6-1. But then he puts him back in, and, you know, okay, we don't necessarily always want to obsess about Paul Pogba, but like it is a kind of a weird one, especially when you've got Donny van de Beek sitting there. Okay, maybe they're different types of players, but, you know, I don't really understand why van de Beek has just been sitting on the bench for the whole season watching these, you know, not great performances. Whereas, Pogba seems to get in, he seems to just be put back in whenever, he can't leave Pogba on the bench the way he has with van de Beek. I don't really understand sort of these decisions that he's been making.
Yeah, I mean, the whole Pogba thing is a concern, particularly given his contract is up. I think it's the end of next season. And United do have a big decision there beyond Solskjaer. What sort of contract do they offer him? They obviously don't want to let him go for free. But we're at the point now where would this team be better off without this constant drama? And Pogba isn't the only issue in that team. It just feels...
The answer to that is definitely. Because, like, when he plays, he doesn't contribute much. You know what I mean? Like you saw him like yesterday. It was such a typical performance by him, I thought. Like, it was, you know, there was one pass, even the one that I'm talking about. It was in the second half. He got the ball sort of in midfield and just played this sort of long pass down the left channel. There was nobody there. It's like, what is that meant to be? You know, there was these moments where he's kind of on the ball, the edge of the box, going to try and shimmy past a couple of players. You know, he can do it, but he doesn't do it. He gets robbed. They're away again on the counter. You're just kind of like this. Like, how did you develop such a big reputation in the first place?
Yeah, I think actually he does personify this whole modern Manchester United era, in that you can see there's some talent. There should be much more there, but he's surprisingly expensive and should be capable of much more, and it's kind of just unreliable. And like before this recent upsurge that started with the Newcastle game, I was talking to someone like connected to United about the various issues that Solskjaer had. And one of the things they said was, at that point, Solskjaer was playing kind of Pogba in that deeper position where it had probably been where he'd been more effective. But from what I was told, Pogba hated playing there and hates playing there. And he wants to be in a more... He basically sees himself as a Bruno Fernandes. And while he's been happy to accept that role for France, because they do have more options, and also I don't, he's not the focal point of the team in the same way, it's not really been the case at United. But so many issues for Solskjaer ripple out from there in terms of how does he configure that midfield. The fact that that squad, in terms of its recruitment and how it's been put together, they're like, it's a possibility that they're kind of real selection dilemmas over about four or five players worth 1 million in wages a week. De Gea is another, although he's kind of steadied a little bit lately. They've got a problem with if Cavani goes in, who goes out of Marshall or Rashford. And it all stems from that. And I suppose these are the big decisions that Solskjaer, the big decisions like Neville is referring to. But again, as Dion said, they've been rumbling on for some time.
No, obviously, like, and they're probably, you know, if Solskjaer was looking to kind of ease Pogba out, and, you know, Martial being suspended probably doesn't help in a sense, in that sense. But if he's looking to ease him out, it should have been done before now. And again, if you look at Arsenal yesterday, and you say, would Arsenal have played the way they played if Arteta was still picking Ozil? Would they have had that purpose if you have one player who you can't rely on to do the things you need them to do? And United have the same problem with Pogba, and then it's compounded by the fact that he gives away the penalty. So I do think it's one of those situations where it's clear now that Solskjaer needs. It's been clear for a long time that Solskjaer needs to act, and I also wonder. Like Solskjaer talks about the Stretford end, you know, missing the Stretford end and sucking in goals. But I think Pogba might be a player who, if there was actually crowds there, this decision would have been made.
Yeah. Well, Pogba was sucking in deep breaths to try to... I mean, he said he was out of breath for that penalty. But Ken, sorry, you wanted to come back in there.
He said he was out of breath, didn't he? Which I thought was kind of an interesting thing to admit to. Although, you mentioned the other bit, if there's crowds there, the decision might have been made. And yeah, I wondered if Pogba was maybe one of those players who was missing the general sort of big time feel around football more than a lot of players. You know, like the kind of, like, it seems to me that you would need to be a particular kind of disciplined and focused professional to thrive in the current very boring football environment.
Don't forget, Paul Pogba is a man who thinks nothing of standing there shirtless at the end of a match arguing his case with Manchester United fans.
That's right.
Which is an image that just popped into my head from a season.
You know, I mean, okay, so it's not as though everyone in that stadium likes him, but it is a big stage. Like, it's exciting to be part of that. It's not exciting to be part of this nonsense. Now, I know that these guys are, like, you know, top professionals. You know, they get paid a ton of money. They need to be serious. They need to knuckle down. They need to remember this is just as important as it is when the whole place is full. But it's not. Everybody knows it's not. It's not the same thing at all. It's a different game. I just wonder if Pogba is one of those. You know, again, everyone has to face the same problem. But I wonder if he's one of those who's particularly badly affected by the, like...
Well, maybe. If you're assuming that things are going well for him then, and then that feeds itself. But if maybe that's the case, and he would be getting more of an adrenaline hit, and it's hard to motivate himself. And I do think that is a factor. There was an interesting comment by the England cricket bowler, fast bowler.
Joffre Archer.
Archer, yeah.
Yeah, I was looking at this as well, yeah.
Yeah, and saying how he's, you know, counting the days until he's free from the various biosecure bubbles he's been playing in since the summer. Now, the cricket bubbles, especially during the summer, were incredibly strict. You know, you were living at the grounds, and he was in a bubble for 87 days, I think. But again, it kind of did. And, you know, everything has to be framed in terms of, oh God, they earn enough money, they can suffer. But that's fine. But when you talk about those intangibles like ego and various aspects of doing the job of being a professional sportsman, special sports person that thrives on crowds, like, that is gone now, and it is an interesting state of mind that they have to adapt to.
And to be fair, that does everything we're talking about here. It also, I mean, you could extend the logic of it to what Pogba is supposed to be as a player. I mean, he's coming into his prime years now, what should be his peak performances. And what would you say Pogba's actual position is? Where do you think he's best? Where? I mean, I'm still kind of at a loss. I've seen him do different things in different positions. But, like, if someone told me what exact type of midfielder he is, or is he better in a kind of a controlling role, should be allowed freedom. I mean, from what I hear, he basically sees himself in almost the Bruno Fernandes role.
I think his best position would be playing alongside Claude Makélélé in a France team 20 years ago. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I just think it's too fast now. Like, the tempo that he plays the game at is not quick enough for the way midfields work now. Like, he's a kind of a guy who's elegant and moves around nicely and hits nice passes, but like, it's not like he's really quick after the ball or really quick to react to sort of changes in direction of play. Like, you wouldn't really trust him as a defensive midfielder, you know, if your team had to attack a lot, like, and he had to be on his guard the whole time. And as a kind of a playmaker, it's a bit too predictable. It's like, oh, is Pogba going to hit a 60-yard diagonal here? Oh, he is, you know. You know,
maybe this is kind of something to do with our own perception of it, but it's hard not to keep coming back to this and to get a little bit Roy Keane about it. Given Pogba's specific talents that we can see, it's difficult not to imagine him where he should be in a situation where his passing is dictating the tempo of the game. I know that's to get Roy about it, but it is, we've never really seen that from him. We've never seen him just where he is the player that's just regularly setting the pace of games, that he's the one making his team move. It's always just kind of delicate touches here and there. And that kind of stand, that goes against the sort of player that he should be for that sort of price and given the talents we know he has.
But I think that comes back to, again, the point you made at the beginning, Miguel, about Solskjaer and, you know, this isn't, you know, Manchester United isn't a finishing school for managers. Like, Solskjaer, Manchester United need a manager that understands when he takes over that Pogba isn't going to be a player that's going to be effective for the way he wants to play. And the fact that, you know, he's 27 now and we're talking about what his best position is, and the fact that this is going on and rumbling on, again, is kind of an indictment. If you look at, it's not a fair comparison in some ways, but if you look at how content Klopp was to let Coutinho go, because he felt there were aspects of his game that were never going to really adapt to the way Klopp wanted to play, and he was a much more effective player for Liverpool. But just that knowledge, just that confidence and that self-belief as a manager that, you know, this is not we're not going to get where I want us to be with this player in the team. And that's the problem. And that's where Keane is right. Like, if Pogba was a totally different player, then Keane wouldn't even need to say it, because then he would be doing all these things. But equally, and then the manager wouldn't need to kind of identify him as somebody that wasn't going to do it in his team, if you know what I mean. But the fact that he isn't, then that becomes the manager's problem. It's all very well to say Paul Pogba should be, you know, he should be fired up and motivating himself, but he's not. And then the manager has to make a decision.
Well, Jose Mourinho also struggled with that. He never really kind of got to the bottom of the problem. Sorry, Miguel. Yeah, very quick point on that. This was going to be my segue into Spurs. So very quick last point on Pogba.
Sorry, I was at the Spurs game and I did have some praise from Mourinho after that. But with Pogba and Mourinho and Solskjaer, there's a similar issue there, right, that comes back almost to what Dion's saying. But Mourinho and Solskjaer are two managers who, with their attacking players, they give them specific instructions, but it's kind of let them do what they want. Whereas, kind of as we've discussed in this show before, very very much the kind of the dynamic at the cutting edge of football now is that attacking players have specific roles and really sophisticated instructions in, you know, all these coordinated modern systems that, you know, Klopp would have, that Guardiola would have, that Pochettino would have, and maybe Pogba would actually benefit from that, from just being given a more defined structure. I mean, I remember two years ago when City were, you know, having, maybe 3 years ago, when they're having their 100-point season, it was regularly put, well, imagine Pogba and that Guardiola team as one of the number eights. And you'd have to imagine he'd thrive much more than this kind of, these bizarre roles where it's all a bit vague, not least his own contribution. But anyway, having criticised Mourinho there.
Yeah, let's talk about Mourinho. I was watching it with a grizzled old football man, Kenny Cunningham, who has seen it all, and I was interested in watching his initial reaction, which he stuck by then when we went on air with it, on the Harry Kane Lallana incident, which he said straight away that's a free the other way. Harry Kane, there's one player who's trying to actually play the ball here, and that's Lallana, who's coming back to try to win the header. Harry Kane knows exactly what he's doing in trying to buy either a free or what turned out to be a penalty. And in fact, he wasn't the only person to make the comparison to rugby and the fact that this is the kind of thing that's actually quite dangerous in rugby. If one guy runs into another person who's airborne and that guy can then come down on his collarbone or whatever, what do you you make of that incident being at the stadium, Miguel?
Yeah, I talk completely the same. I thought it was a free out. And it's something that someone had switched me on to a few weeks ago when he did it with Cresswell. And now there's actually a series of examples of this with Kane. And because it's not just that a player jumps over me or he doesn't jump, it's that he has a clear look. This has happened a lot. And I think, and it's interesting now that people are starting to cotton on to this. Because even throughout the game yesterday, there was a moment a few minutes afterwards where Byrne for Brighton, he refused to jump with Kane for it and actually brought it to the attention of the ref. Look at this. And I do wonder whether Kane's going to start getting a little bit of heat for it.
Well, I mean, he should, because it's like, it's a really obvious. I mean, especially when you get a penalty for that at the expense of your England, you know, colleague as well, Adam Lallana. Now, I know he's only been a minor colleague, but still, England. And, you know, to do that, to get a penalty, he wasn't even in the box. Like, that's surely going to bring down a bit of heat. What do you think, though, Dion, of Tottenham's new number nine, Gary Bale, as Jose might call him, his teed up by his Madrid mate, Reguilon. And some Mourinho's comment afterwards that I'm now going to Safari to look on Madrid's website to see what they are saying about him. What are you thinking about where Tottenham are at the moment? Obviously, they're second in the league, but Kane is scoring a lot. You know, Kane is having a great start to the season. Like, I was doubtful as to whether Kane would ever really be able to perform the way that he had. You know, when the Pochettino team was good, it looks as though maybe he can, at least for the moment. That's what he's doing. Son is playing well, and then you got Bale to put in as well. Suddenly, the Tottenham team actually looks really dangerous, capable of scoring a lot of goals. And I mean, do you think that means they have enough then, Dion, to win the league?
Yeah, I think they've enough to make a title challenge this season, because it's going to be a very strange, long, drawn-out season with, I think, you know, a lot of struggles for lots of clubs. So I definitely think they have a chance. And I think, you know, for Mourinho to have that added factor of, you know, for him to be able to reference Madrid every time Gareth Bale scores, when we're able to reference Real Madrid, I think is kind of a nice an added factor for Mourinho, that he can point out how he is resurrecting Gareth Bale, freeing him from, you know, endless hours on the golf course. And I think they do look like a strong team in a league where there isn't, you know, with Liverpool being the only real, you know, and with Liverpool's problems as well, like, you know, Liverpool being the only real strong contender, the Spurs are definitely in there.
You don't think Man City are a strong contender?
No.
Really?
Not this season. No, I don't.
I mean, they've had a good week, you know, they're very professional. Marseille dispatched, Sheffield United dispatched. You know,
I think this season is going to be. I think when we talk about, I really think when you talk about all the factors combined into this season, the quick turnaround, the number of games, the empty stadiums. I think all of that is going to really amplify the problems that exist between Pep Guardiola and the Manchester City squad. I think the last thing, you know, to be trying to do. To try to kind of respond to everything Pep Guardiola is constantly asking for you, from you, year upon year, week upon week, and to have to do it in empty stadiums where the only voice you're ever going to hear is Pep Guardiola's. I think that's going to be a problem as the season goes on. But I do also think that, I think the Kane thing is actually really, it was like that is that what he did yesterday was so reckless, and the fact that it is kind of being highlighted now is important, because that was a really, it's a kind of extraordinary that he's kind of getting away with it, even when you look at that and you
not
think,
just getting away with it, he's winning penalties.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like that one was such an obvious foul by Harry Kane. Like, I don't know how. Like, it's extraordinary, that this is what he's getting away from, and like, you know, and it's so dangerous. The way Lallana fell last night was appalling.
Yeah. Do you agree, Miguel, with Dion there that Liverpool are the only class team? I mean, this is the team that has had its heart ripped out, as we know. Is the heartless remnant of this team still good enough to win the title? They are playing
Man City next weekend. So that game is at Man City, for all that's worth. Do you think that that's going to clarify things? Do you expect Liverpool to walk away with that one?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about this a fair bit, and ultimately the season is gone. I mean, that game will tell us a little bit next Sunday, although the way it goes right now, a lot of the big six games feel a little bit inconsequential at the moment, given how the season's pan out. But this is ultimately going to come down to who can basically get over the threshold of 80 points. I think Liverpool, even allowing for the problems that are going to come in defence without Van Dijk, I think they've just got enough firepower to do that. With City, I mean, the murmurs about City have basically been that it's not completely unlike a Mourinho season in 2015-16. Now, it's highly unlikely to go that bad as it did with Mourinho-Chelsea. But basically that the players are just a bit mentally fatigued by the intensity of the last few years, which is why it's harder for City to get anywhere near the levels they did in 2017-18 and 2018-19. And of course, they've lost some of the key players in that regard, like Kompany, who would have set a certain tone. But I mean, you can almost see it with Guardiola. I mean, just how we see it in the sideline, we see it in press conferences. And imagine dealing with that every day. It's why managers like Ferguson made drastic changes after every 3 years. And there is an interesting broader stat there that in the entire history of English football, there's only been three coaches who have actually ever had a title team and very quickly or at all created another title team at the same club. They're Bob Paisley, who did it once, Wenger, who did it once, and Ferguson did it three or four times. And like Guardiola's almost into two unknowns there, in that he's never been at a club this long, longer than the fourth season, and never had to do this to recreate a second title team. And it's why I think Mourinho or Spurs could run them quite close. I don't think they'll have enough to beat Liverpool over the course of the season. But I was thinking this more so, games against Southampton or where Kane and Son have been flying together, in that there's a bit of a contentment in Mourinho right now. And if you look at it in a wider sense, this is basically the first time he's got everything he wants in terms of the situation, in terms of signings, since the summer of 2014. In summer of 2014, he got Fabregas, Costa, and Felipe Luis at Chelsea. And they immediately kind of clicked as a team. And it comes back to what we're saying about Solskjaer and how he coaches, in that Mourinho has this whole, his belief is guided discovery, and that attackers, I mean, it's one of these things, the technical coaching educational terms, but the fundamental is that attackers figure out problems for themselves. So it means that when everyone is on form and there's a general mood of happiness around a Mourinho team, they can be really good. The players can click and interchange and look put together some really good football, as we saw in that first few months of Chelsea in 2014-15, and as we're seeing at the moment with Spurs. The problems arise, as eventually happened even that title-winning season with Chelsea, and it bled into the next season, the disaster of 15-16, when the kind of form dissipates, a few kind of rumbles emerge, and there's no broader system to fall back on in the way you see with Klopp or with Guardiola. But I think for the moment, there's enough to sustain a lot of form for Spurs. I'd say we could have a situation where, you know, we might have the fun for a while of the main potential title race being Liverpool against Mourinho.
Yeah, hopefully. Well, hopefully. I know there's a lot of scenarios that could be a bit of fun this year. I'll leave it at that, though. Thanks a billion, Miguel. Thank you, Dion. Thanks a lot.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
The boys of Liverpool, when we safely landed, call myself the fool.
Let's go to the club!
It began to boil. Temper I was new as empowered old Aaron's oil. They began abusing her.
Sorry, mate.
Is your Wi-Fi?
What a boy you are.
He knew why I had come. That's actually my seat.
Wi-Fi workers!
I don't know what you're talking about.
We've actually just been told to sit anywhere.
You want Wi-Fi workers?
The seat numbers don't count.
Hunt the hare and turn her down the rocky road and all the ways to double a
McFarlane.
What have we got now tonight? Two more games in, including Leeds-Leicester. So that should be interesting. That one's on Sky Sports. And what a week it is. Liverpool-Atlanta tomorrow night. We'll be on top of that.
Oh, the Champions League is on again, is it? Oh, what a surprise. I can't believe the Champions League is on.
I was just going to say, Coronation Street. Like, it's
Ken's
ridiculous
attitude to Champions League isn't exactly helping my selling of the World Service hype job here. That's what I'm trying to do. Stick with us for all the Champions League coverage during the week. It's going to be amazing.
More Champions League than you can scrape off your shoes.
Well, speaking of scraping things off your shoes.
Nah, go on the rocks.
Ah, come on, Doddles. Not in the. No, I'm saying. No, Doddles you're. Would no, have to you're throw. I'm not saying.
Your throw was in poor taste. The clip itself, obviously in poor taste, but all in all, that left a very sour taste.
I'm just worried if O'Doherty starts doing this in the middle of the city. I mean, is this an ackle you're on now, David?
Yeah, he's gotta, not going to get away with it. He's not going to get away with it in Dublin.
Episode 1 is out today, available to all. I haven't heard it yet myself, so better wrap things up here and give it a listen. You can sign up to the World Service now to get isolating right through the week. You know you need it in your life right now. And, you know, we will talk about the Champions League also on the regular podcast. Just in really bored, monotone kind of voices.
No, Owen, incorrect. Once it's on, Ken will get excited again. Don't worry. Yeah.
Thanks, Murph. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Owen. Thank you, Kieran.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you, Owen.
Talk to you soon.
But yeah, I did. I went in the rocks.
That's the second time it's gone off. They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's the persuasion of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.